Hello. It's good to talk to you. This is officially the last talk of the term. We'll have our last class meeting on the pad tomorrow, and we will then be in the cycle of editing and rewriting. I should have comments back on the first draft of second essays at the beginning of next week. And then I presume probably after you have taken exams and relieved yourselves of the obligations of your other courses, you can do rewriting of the first essay if you haven't already submitted a second draft, and of the second essay. Grading deadline is the 8th of January in order to fit the winter interview season into the schedule of the plague year. The requirement that grades be returned by the 8th of January is for your benefit, not for anybody else's. If you wish to continue revising your essays after the 8th of January, I require only that you send me an email message saying I wish to have extensions to continue working on my essays in Law and Internet Society. I will automatically grant those extensions so that we can continue working until February 1 or beyond if we deem it desirable. I don't think that the semester barrier is a sensible way of organizing 21st century education under any circumstances. Moreover, it is the official doctrine of the university that the semester system doesn't exist this year, that all of 2021 is a single academic unit. The president decreed that at the beginning of the plague period, and everybody has adopted that as official doctrine. So for a change, there isn't any official semester boundary. There is, however, an early and obviously burdensome for you grading deadline under the assumption that it will assist your job hunting, because the winter interview session, which I doubt. In any event, if I have a written request for an extension, we can continue to work on your essays for as long as you find it useful to write and receive comments and rewrite, etc., because I think that's how the education works. Otherwise, I will expect to have two drafts of two essays before the week of January 8th, and that I will be engaged in reading and submitting grades during the week between the 4th and the 8th of January. Those continuing into my next offering, Computers, Privacy, and the Constitution in the spring term, those are the essays that will be written in that course, also two of them, and in the same style as this, will be different works on different subjects. They will not continue from one to the other. So if you are planning to or have enrolled in the second offering, then we will do two other pieces together, and they will be different. You will choose what the topics are as always, but they will be different topics. That's the housekeeping for the moment. Keep watch on the front page of the course next week. Don't delete your notifications just yet. There may be more, but not for you to worry about, only for me to offer or to worry about myself. I have various ideas about how we might use next week, but it's not your responsibility to prepare. We have come to the second part of the question. So what do we do about all this? And I won't restate beyond a couple of sentences where we stand, but for the purpose of making sure that we are all on the same non-existent page, let's just review the whole of the situation very briefly. We have created an external nervous system which will soon embrace the whole of humanity. Every single human being from birth to death will be connected to the net. That net can be used socially to create any number of different conditions in human society. I, at least, and others, comrades of mine with whom I worked over the decades as this anatomy and its physiology were developing, I and others thought that the primary reason for the creation of the net was the extirpation of ignorance. That we could make it possible for every brain on earth to learn whatever it wanted, wherever it wanted, anytime, regardless of the ability to pay or the attitude of governments about what ought to be learnable. This ambition for the massive increase in the quantity of human intelligence and for the absolute right of every human mind to develop itself according to its own instincts, wishes, whims, plans, and to achieve its own destiny was, from our point of view, the fulfillment of the dream of the freedom of thought that had been occupying at least the mind of some part of the human race every single moment for the last 1,000 years. That's not what happened. It's still possible that it could happen. The net that we have made, the nervous system of humanity, still has that among other possibilities implicit within it. It also has, as I and comrades of mine began to understand when we were teenagers in the early 1970s, it has the possibility of becoming instead the machinery of perfected despotism. The idea of the 20th century of totalitarianism, a form of hierarchical state power that reaches into every sphere of human life, that has no space left over for the private or the civil, but which is entirely capable of reaching everywhere and seeing, understanding, and controlling everything, which led to mass murder and to other evident pathologies of human life in the 20th century, is now a dream attainable through this nervous system in the 21st. The experiments of the Chinese Communist Party in the perfection of despotism, first in its frontier lands like Xinjiang, that meaning the new frontier, and in the urban and entirely modernist environments of its large cities, and in, most importantly, at present Hong Kong, demonstrate the modes in which the use of the net for the perfection of despotism can now be implemented with money and power and time, but pretty soon with absolute completeness. We haven't spent as much time as we might on the question of payment systems and the cashless economy in the course of this term. Eventually, I suspect that will have to become a third course altogether and a separate focus of interest. But for the moment, what we have done is sufficient to explain the ways in which once cash, an anonymous system of payment, has disappeared, and every transaction, every purchase and sale in every human life, everywhere in society, occurs against the background of electronic payment, is tied to a phone and a fingerprint and the personal identity of the Aadhaar-like electronic kind in India. Once the payment system too is fully brought into the network, then the very activities of human life, the basic business of getting on a bus or buying a sandwich, becomes a point at which interference by the state, refusal as well as monitoring, is available, and there is, as I said in the first Snowden lecture, the perfection of the Roman imperial position that when the emperor controls the entirety of the known world, there is never anywhere to run. The shaping of this network contains, however, more choices than the perfection of freedom of thought and the perfection of totalitarian despotism. It contains also the pathway which this and other developed supposedly democratic societies are on, in which the physiology of the net is determined by the existence at the center of the digital form of life that I have called the parasite with the mind of God. The engagement system, the system which uses hardware built to surveil its nominal owner and which is used as a platform for the delivery of influencing of human behavior through advertising and other forms of immediate impact. The neural network that attaches to you through the neuron that we call the phone, but which is actually a device for monitoring the body and the mind and for dropping stimuli on top of the body and the mind in order to collect responses to those stimuli, including purchases, swipes, clicks, lefts, rights, and everything else. The machinery of the network has come in the last 10 years to be tailored to this form of commensal life with the organism that metabolizes collected behavior and secretes hormones that induce more human behavior in the network. This, as I have spent the last couple of weeks trying to elucidate, this form of the network, rather than producing freedom of the mind, produces instead a form of behaviorist nullification of the mind, in which the vast proportion of people's lives are spent in the effort to remain engaged with an entity which wishes to remain engaged with them, and which intermediates most or all of their human contact through the system of behavior acquisition and efforts to provide influence on a purely behaviorist basis, which denies in its most fundamental sense, like the 20th century psychology out of which it has developed, which provides for a form of the human race in which the idea of mind is no longer necessarily part of human psychology. The consequence is a pollution, an environmental disaster in the nature of human thought, which is in particular corrosive of the idea of freedom which existed over that long thousand-year period in which the freedom of the mind and the freedom of the body and the freedom of the soul were all connected via the idea of the internal space in which a human being reads and thinks and learns and motivates her or himself to act as part of a community of similarly autonomous, free-thinking human beings. The question which we face now at the end of this course is the question, how might law and politics and technology work together to alter the physiology of this network and therefore to repurpose the network towards the maintenance of traditional or aspirational human values, which in its present physiology that network is undermining. I began the effort to sketch the forms of technical, legal, and political effort that would modify the physiology of this network in that direction last week. I pointed once again, as we did at the beginning of the term, in relation to the substance of intellectual property rules primarily copyright and patent rules in the area of software to further explore the argument that the idea of sharing the software which produces the physiology of the network, collaborating in its production, and granting users rights to understand, to study, to copy, to modify, and share that software, which therefore puts the individual learning how to understand software, learning how to make software, and acting to improve her own life and the lives of the people around her by technical effort, why that particular movement was both intended to and did increase the degree of freedom and human self-discovery and human self-government in the network. By providing for a concept of the user's rights at the center of the system of software making, and by enabling that system of users' rights through a manipulation, a hack of the system of copyright, using the exclusive rights given to authors by the copyright law to provide actually for the authors to protect and nurture users' rights, the free software idea both models the way that the ethics of human values can be incorporated in the very substance of the network, and created a network built upon free software that had enclosed within it, in its respect for the rights of users, the ideas necessary to turn the network into a vehicle for securing perpetually the freedom of thought. But it's also the case that this same system of technical organization facilitated the rise of great capitalist entities, whether they are capitalist entities emerging from a supposedly communist society, such as Alibaba and Tencent, or they are capitalist entities emerging from free market capitalist democracies, such as Google, Facebook, and Twitter. All such entities depended upon the free software ecology in order to operate. The technical paradigms of their operation converge more and more towards the need for the forms of heterogeneous collaborative software making that give rise to the entities we now call the web and the cloud. That is to say, without the basis of free software technologies and free software ideas, those entities could not have cooperated to assemble the parasite with the mind of God and to learn how to use the parasite to become humanly rich. So one part of the effort involved in altering the physiology of the network back towards the cherishing of human values and the development of freedom of thought, one root, one leg on the stool that we will pose the human future on, is the technological effort to ensure continued respect and expanded implementation of users' rights. The fundamental concept is to begin from rights and to endow those rights into the population of those who use the net, that is, all of us, each individually in our role as users and collectively in our role as the makers, installers, fixers, modifiers, and fundamental innovators in the physiology of that network through our ability to learn how it works now, to modify its working by changing code, and by understanding how to share effectively with one another. Once we have done that, the physiology of the net becomes humanly responsive, both at the level of the individual child working to change the way its home relates to the network, and which governs to some significant extent the method by which that child learns, and also at the collective level in which we can reorient the market for services away from email and web support and social sharing provided, quote, free, close quote, in return for the behavior collection that nourishes the parasite, towards forms of cooperative society in which I provide you with email service and you provide me with a system for my social sharing, and we all share the software which is used to do all those things, and we all use cheap, omnipresent little hardware to provide not a Google next to a waterfall using cheap hydropower to collect our behavior in return for offering us calendaring services, but rather in which we all in our neighborhoods provide to one another all the services that we need. The economics of the hardware in which cheap computation is omnipresent that will do everything that you need and that your family needs and that 3 or 4 or 10 other households need, all using a single board computer that fits in the palm of your hand and costs less than $100. Software which is free of cost everywhere because we make it together and share it and everybody has rights in it. And bandwidth, which is ultimately like the air and the water that we drink, a common resource which we build like our roads and which we use like our streets to saunter, run, and paddle around exactly as we feel like, all of those put together can offer the political economy of a network which is liberating not only from the traditional constraints of cost and government censorship over the flow of ideas, but which also removes the nourishment for the parasite, which, deprived of the ability comprehensively to collect all human behavior all the time, then does what parasites do. When our bodies will no longer nourish them, it withers away and is excreted towards the dumps where we keep our old software and our old hardware. But it is obvious that technological changes alone will not suffice to constitute the better net any more than they ever suffice to analyze and to intervene in the behavior of the net we built, the one we do not want. At the second half of the last class, or of this last, of the last talk, I was beginning to evolve the part of the triadic answer which arises in the law. And here, as I said last time, we are dealing with the ecological element of this, that each of us engaged in ordinary daily interactions with the parasite, clicking yes, I accept terms of service we haven't read, and accepting wonderful new free services, and downloading new wonderful free applications, and having all this convenience, surrendering all our anxieties to the net, which tells us which way to walk and what to eat and whom to sleep with and all those other wonderful things. When we begin to assess the global consequences of our local decisions, when we aggregate over the whole of the human race the consequences of all that wonderful individual, quote, convenience, close quote, we begin to understand that this too is an ecological rather than a transactional problem, that like the nature of the heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere generated by everything from tailpipe emissions of our cars to the inadequate insulation of our houses to the vast forms of intervention in atmospheric chemistry created by the fossil fuel industries that support the generation of electricity and the conduct of agriculture, when we glimpse the ways in which this network's purpose is to globalize the individual, we understand that in the end, the forms of legal structuring over the network will inevitably take some similar analogical pathways to those of our efforts at environmental law. And as I said last time, the depth of that analogy in structure and function of our legal interventions should be made explicit, and we should conduct our efforts at legal analysis and construction directly in the forms that we have also used to construct our environmental legal order. Here, the system of the United States in its broad architectural details is useful to adopt as a form of prototype for the kinds of legal interventions necessary to restore the forms of privacy that are not only secrecy and anonymity, but autonomy. So let us then resume where we were last time by saying that the fundamental plinth of such a system, the stone on which everything else rests, becomes a National Privacy Policy Act, which has some of the same basic constituent elements as the National Environmental Policy Act brought into existence under the presidential administration of Richard Nixon. The NEPA, like the NPPA that I am imagining, has as its role to provide three foundational elements in the conduct of the policy that brings the net we do not want into line with the net we do want, the one that enables the long-term prosperity of the human mind. The first element in that structure is the requirement to make policy in light of the nature of the broad problem. That is to say, to require that government in its actions in the intervention in the private economy shall overtly and explicitly consider the consequences for the privacy environment like the consequences for the physical environment. That impact statements, that is, official reasonings on government policy shall issue with respect to all the forms of intervention in which government engages, how it organizes the telecommunications network, which is the anatomy of the net, how it organizes the relationship between that communications anatomy and the companies that play within it, those which are regulated public utilities, those which are special purpose entities created to use telecoms in particular ways, those which are the sources of knowledge or expertise or specialized materials for that network. The second fundamental element in the basis of the environmental law is the agency. That is to say, the creation of a unit of government whose purpose it is to make rules, conduct investigations, and engage in quasi-prosecutorial activity in combination with other elements of government, which sits in the cabinet or the forms a crucial policy-making part of the administration of the society, and which engages at levels of other federalist organization with state and local governments for the purpose of dealing with the matters that are committed to their control and that lie within their territorial reach. Like the Environmental Protection Administration, a privacy protection agency becomes part of the architecture of government. It becomes the clearinghouse for information. It organizes and relates to the scientific and engineering skills of the society. It acts as a protagonist in legal activity by suing and by rulemaking, and it therefore provides a center in social and political and policy thinking for the society to use as its way of establishing, as technology changes and as the challenges become apparent from old technologies that have had externality consequences of one or another unanticipated kind. It acts as an interlocutor for the legislature in the making of new law, and it provides for the forms of reliable and truth-based public information, which, as we have seen in the world of the epidemic, is absolutely crucial to long and short-term social health. The last of the component pieces of such an privacy policy act is the judicial interventions which are made possible by the requirement for judicial review of the agency's activities and by the provision of private rights of action in the legislation, which allow citizens and their aggregate policy organizations to use the courts to require precision in impact statements, to require the privacy protection agency to engage with particular social problems, and which allow competing interest groups to use the system of litigation to challenge and defend government action. Such a system is, as I say, a plinth, a platform, a pedestal upon which other elements of the legal response need to be organized. In the case of the environmental law system of the United States, we can see on top of that institutional basis created by the National Environmental Policy Act a series of specialized legislative acts which are concerned with individual portions of the environment: the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, CERCLA, which provides what we call the Superfund for the detoxification and cleaning up of particular environmental disasters resulting from previously unregulated emissions of dangerous material into the physical environment, and under construction, not yet fully visible in the form of legislation owing to the partisan polarization of the United States government on this subject, ultimately a Climate Act, which uses more than the Clean Air Act's power for the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, which is really, in a way, a kind of technical kludge. The ultimate shape of the climate policy system will have to be embodied both in domestic legislation that effectuates international commitments under Kyoto and Paris when we rejoin, and the next round of absolutely crucial international lawmaking with respect to emissions as we try and head towards carbon neutral societies, but which are in that sense part of a larger vertical in which our air and our water and our sea levels and our public land use planning systems are all sensitized to climate relationships. If we were not in a system of partisan deadlock on this subject, we would have remained within the scope of the Paris Agreement, and we would have begun to make all the various forms of local to national to global activity with respect to climate part of some system of legislated interactions like those of the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act. In other words, we can imagine then, with respect to an analogous system of privacy regulations for the protection of the human intellectual and social environment, a similar series of verticals, looking less like the existing system of privacy protection law in the United States, almost all of which is about the type of information. Video rental records, because of the historical accident of Robert Bork's porn video rentals, health information under HIPAA, financial information under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, rather than forms of legislation which are particular to types of information, one would expect instead of forms of verticalization of the privacy environment that are related either to types of activities or types of rights. The most obvious missing legislative conception in the current environment is the regulation of behavior collection. We still have systems of telecommunications regulation and an entire agency devoted to its accomplishment, which assumed that the anatomy of the network is the 20th century telecommunications system providing 20th century telecommunication services through regulated common carriers. A form of activity which has, of course, continue to exist. There are still telephone companies, but they are behavior collection companies providing telecommunications services as the cheese on the mousetrap. And the platform companies, the service providers, not of connection services in the anatomy of the net, but sharing services in its physiology. That is to say, the Twitters and Facebooks and Googles, which although they may occasionally, like Google Fiber, interact with the underlying anatomy, mostly on the basis that it is good for the platform companies to subsidize physical connection in order to have preferential access to the packets containing human behavior. But fundamentally, the business is collecting behavior and using it to sell opportunities for behavioral influence through advertising and equivalent forms. The form of legislation that would follow from an effort to understand this as the centerpiece of economic activity rather than switching services or burying cables under the street, the form in which such a behavior collection regulation act, like the Clean Air Act, would operate would be by indicating the differential between what is acceptable in the realm of behavior collection and what is not acceptable. Part of this has to do with scale, just as it does in the measurement of particular quantities or concentrations of chemicals that may be emitted into the atmosphere, where the questions are inevitably involved in cost-benefit analysis in particular industrial situations. Benzene is a carcinogen. And the question of how much to regulate the emission of benzene depends upon other things, upon whether you power automobiles with gasoline and require gasoline stations, which will be places where benzene escapes into the atmosphere when tanks are filled, which is different from the emission of benzene in large quantities from other forms of chemical manufacturing. Where the question becomes how much mercury can be emitted into the atmosphere from plants, power plants burning coal, we are both considering the question, do power plants burn coal? And also, what technologies for removing mercury from coal smoke should be required of power plants that burn coal, and what should be required of new ones, and what should be required for retrofitting on old ones, all with the purpose of surveying overall how much dangerous mercury is emitted into the atmosphere or into our waterways, and which parts can be most effectively controlled, both with respect to human health and with respect to the realities of particular economic and productive processes. A Behavior Collection Act, therefore, has the same elements that Clean Air Act has. It requires consideration about what forms of behavior collection are particularly toxic, which doesn't always mean that it is personally identifiable behavior, or that it is equally important which personally identifiable behavior is collected from which persons. Nonetheless, we would expect a behavior collection act to begin from a determination of the individual rights of citizens. What are their rights in information concerning their behavior? What is the relationship of the distinction between being at home and being in public and being on the job to the question what our rights are in the collection of our behavior? But it is not only a matter of determining what our individual rights are in the collection of our behavior, it is also a matter of considering what behavior collection en masse can do to affect individual rights. That is to say, what happens when we infer information about citizens from other information that has been collected about other citizens? What happens when we are so massively engaged in collecting behavior that we can find individuals in society based not upon what they do, but about who they are? You are like these other people in X, Y, Z, T, and W ways. Therefore, we infer that you are also like other people in A, B, C ways, and we repress or punish or control people who are A, B, C, and we have therefore decided on the basis of your similarity to others on X, Y, Z, T, and W axes that you are an appropriate subject of repression, control, intervention, etc. We have considered the subject of the collection of behavior of learning. We considered it in the middle 1970s as a consequence of the effort of one United States Senator, William F. Buckley's brother, James, whose Buckley Amendment to the Family and Educational Records Privacy Act created the system of educational privacy in the United States in the pre-digital pencil and paper era. But as you see around you in the world of digital education and hyper-powered by the epidemic, the rules of educational privacy are shifting as behavior collecting entities infiltrate universities, and universities and schools begin to discover that behavior collection is a form of potential income that can be used to help support otherwise underfunded educational activity. As we understand the role of the collection of educational data, we begin to understand that it furthers the development of a caste system in society in which, from a very early age, the tracking of all learning behavior begins to establish early judgments about what categories particular human beings fall into, and the destinies of human beings begin to be determined earlier and earlier in lifetime by the system of educational records tracking. Aldous Huxley imagined in Brave New World the creation of a caste system of society through actual biological manipulation in gestation, that the alphas, betas, and gammas of a future society would be determined by the physiological environment of artificial gestation. Inside the test tubes, the alpha, beta, and gamma-ness of the human race would be determined. But in fact, it's simpler and more effective to build a caste system on the basis of observing the innate variability of the human body and the human mind. Nature makes people, and the system of educational behavior collection sorts out the alphas and the betas and the gammas from one another. The systems of behavior collection, which involve the forms of behavior to which all human beings inevitably recurred, the eating and the having sex and the forms of habitual life behavior that consist of pair bonding or non-pair bonding and with whom we pair and all of that, raise other questions which the United States Supreme Court identifies in the word privacy, decisions about whom we love and how we bear and beget children. And all of that information, too, a society can collect with a camera at every street corner and a microphone in every nightclub and dating services which keep track of everything you swipe, no matter whether you wind up connecting with that human being or not. And pretty soon we are, at least in theory, capable of automated intervention in the fine detail, the fine structure detail of human psychological activity in relation to our basic biological instincts. All of those forms of information, like information about our bodies themselves, about the physiological condition of our bodies, the pathologies which invade us over the course of a lifetime, the nature of the molecules we ingest, whether prescribed or self-chosen, all of that information also creates loci of power over the human being. Presently in the United States, being largely collected by insurance companies, which have become the dominant organizers of the physiological intervention system we call healthcare, but which are also interested in all the forms of behavior, the private activities, which have an effect on the degree of doctoring we need or want. In all these areas, the common phenomenon is the collection of behavior and the use of collected behavior to analyze, infer, and conclude, allowing action to be taken by private or public actors that deliberately influences, controls, or punishes human conduct. A Behavior Collection Act, in other words, has as its fundamental architectural purpose the detection of the commonalities that exist in the present system of sector-focused or type of information-focused regulation of collection. What to do with video rental receipts when there are no video rental companies left, but streaming services are becoming the dominant form of cultural distribution in the society. What to do about the changes over time in data science and its application to human existence, what we presently call, a little bit misleadingly, the ethics of artificial intelligence. The relation between our aspiration for human equality, which we put over the front door of our Supreme Court and which we put on the coinage and which we make at least a show of believing with respect to the long-term forms of inequality and injustice that arise out of inequality in our society, the relation between our belief in civil equality and the denial of equality, which comes from the perspective on the society had by the parasite with the mind of God, in which every single human being's behavior is collected and the emergent properties of that data collection allow us to categorize human beings, to recognize human beings, to misrecognize human beings, and to apply the resulting forms of, quote, scientific, close quote, inequality in new and different ways. The caste system in education that arises from the pervasive monitoring of learning behavior from cradle to diploma is both an example and the functional platform for future discrimination. Structures which sort human beings neurologically are no more acceptable for the imposition of inequality than structures which sort according to other phenotypic categories like color of skin. But they are also necessary in ways which may interact with our determination for equality, against the so-called data-driven rational discriminations which arise from what we know about individual human beings and the groupings into which they fall. The civil rights aspect of the behavior collection regulation system is one of the more important elements that future legislation will have to address. And it should address it not as the question of the ethics of AI or the forms of discrimination that are temporarily bothering us. Does facial recognition software work better on persons with pink skin than on persons with brown skin? Those are elements in the process of rulemaking, like the elements that arise when new chemicals are found in the drinking water, and the question becomes, what are the safe limits for chemicals in the drinking water that didn't used to be there? What is the science of a particular form of chemistry, like what is the science of a particular form of data science with respect to its social outcomes? But the more important aspect of the legislation of behavior collection is to define the rights that are fundamental and to use those rights as the points of leverage for the construction of systems of rulemaking and adjudication which protect those rights in a structure of cost-benefit analysis and balancing against the other social efforts being made at the same time. We want better healthcare. We want more targeted use of pharmaceutical molecules. But we are unwilling to tolerate that everybody's blood pressure should be taken by their phone every 15 seconds and transmitted to a national blood pressure clearinghouse, as a result of which we decide to put some level of beta blockers in the drinking water, right? Those are the kinds of problems that we can, in a science fiction mode, hypothesize. But our task is not to write the science fiction. Our task is to write the narrative construction engine which allows society to think about such questions in a uniform and consistent and professionalized way. So let us imagine then, in addition to the behavior collection regulation statute, like the Clean Air Act, the other elements that we require for a national privacy policy structure. We have, in addition to behavior collection, the questions of the regulation of advertising. Here, the point is not to control whether people can be persuaded to buy one brand of toilet paper or another. Here, the question is, what do we think about putting a billboard on every street corner? What do we think about bullhorns in the middle of the night rolling down our streets? What do we think about ambiance and the protection of quiet or view or other forms of human psychological interaction with the environment that are cheapened or debilitated or entirely made impossible by structures of economic exploitation? We decide that mountaintop removal coal mining is an unacceptable way of managing the physical environment because what it leaves behind is the gap-toothed structure of post-industrial squalor that used to be the beauty of our hills and the forests covering them. From the point of view of thinking about land use regulation, German social sentiment about the preservation of forest land, or English social sentiment about the preservation of greenways and agricultural forms of land usage, which are the traditional and sentimentally cherished view of the English countryside, or the vast importance of the maintenance of wilderness as part of the riches of the American of the North American landmass. These elements are not merely matters of chemistry and physics. They are matters of the aesthetic commitment of the society. Each of us may, in our own lives, determine how much advertising intervention is acceptable in our view of the life we want to lead. My apartment is destitute of advertising intervention. I am not allowing advertising-based radio or television or audio or video into my world. I am relentlessly scrubbing all advertising from things that I see on the web. I am not permitting the forms of notification intrusion, buzzing, beeping, making my physical sleep intervened in by notifications. The process of sculpting for myself the nature of the sensory environment in which I work, in which I read and write and think and speak and teach and learn, is so crucial to my own well-being as a thinking, breathing, feeling human being, that I believe that I should have not merely privileges but rights to the control of that neurosensory environment and to simply opt out of the process of attention conscription, which is a major part of the economic theory of the day. In this, I may be like the American of the 18th century frontier who moves when he can smell the smoke from his neighbor's chimney, ever outward, westward, towards the empty land in which the air is uncontaminated by the burning of other human beings. And perhaps in the end it comes to seem like the Clean Air Act, no longer possible simply for me to move away from my neighbors, but rather to have some control over the extent to which their smoke is smellable, because there isn't any smoke. In this sense, then, another part of the structure of the privacy policy is not the control of behavior collection, but the regulation of the intrusiveness of advertising. It's not unreasonable to say that products sold in interstate commerce could be regulated for the extent to which they contain attention conscripting technologies that users cannot disable. It's not unreasonable to say that the protection of our environment against noise pollution, the single largest volume of citizen complaints in New York City over the 311 interaction with government for non-emergency purposes line, the single largest volume of complaints have to do with noise. It's not unreasonable to think about the regulation of the visual and auditory environment of the society as part of the structure of the privacy of that society, or the dictation of the balance of negotiating power between the individual and large-scale consumer-facing systems with respect to who determines what is an acceptable form of intervention in the neural life of the citizen. We need an educational privacy structure which goes beyond the FERPA of 1976 and which constricts the nature of the forms of social discrimination which can arise from the collection of information about education. And here again, the process is not one of establishing an absolute and holding a line, no law means no law in First Amendment interpretation, as we shall discuss in the next term's class in part one. But rather, the process of establishing in a rights-based structure the nature of the individual developing mind's entitlement to the privacy of learning. I have stressed again and again in this course the crucial element of the anonymity of reading. Anonymity of reading, that is to say, protection from being monitored in everything we look at for the purpose of learning from it, is surely a part of the privacy of thought element, but it's not the only one. And here, in the ecological determination to protect privacy as autonomy, we are likely to find ourselves for the first time thinking about freedom of thought not as a broad subject contained within an even broader constitutional provision like the First Amendment, but an actual operational right such as the other kinds of rights that we see growing out of statute rather than out of broad constitutional provision. What are the operational challenges to the maintenance of freedom of thought in society, and how do we regulate so as to address those challenges rationally in the achievement of social consensus? Measurement of learning progress is crucial to educational activity. I read what you write, I make comments, you write back, I think about the nature of the effort, the commitment, and the improvement that resulted from that editorial intervention and your rewriting. And eventually, though I think it's a pretty stupid form of response, something eventuates that's called a grade. But the idea that I should, in that process, have a clear monitoring judgment about how many seconds you spent reading this, and how many seconds you spent reading that, and did you reread something that I assigned, or did you skim it quickly, did your writing happen bit by bit, or did you sit down and type the whole thing out all at once, that's none of my business. And the idea that it's none of my business goes further when we ask whether it should be the dean's business, or the university's business, or a potential employer's business. The nature of the form of self-development that we call education should be protected against the idea that everything is a rat race and everything is a maze with monitoring in it everywhere. As my brilliant contemporaries discovered in the course of their development as computer scientists, most brilliant of all, my comrade Deborah Estrin, the world of the trillion sensor universe can be an enormously powerful one. To restore again our analogy to the physical environment, it was in 1979 on a family vacation to Costa Rica that Deb first thought to herself, what if the rainforest had so many sensors in it that the forest could sense itself? That it could understand its ecological environment holistically. Eventually, of course, in the course of our growing up as human beings, as we all traveled around the sun, Deb and all the rest of us discovered that, in fact, the trees have been doing this for some several hundred million years now. They have been learning, in fact, to treat one another as sensors and engaging in complex chemical messaging of the very kind she had in mind. But as Deb began to think about the computer science of the trillion sensor universe, she realized that ultimately the most important venue wasn't the rainforest, it was the hospital. And from that, she began to understand why it was that my free software problem was also her free software problem. Because a trillion sensor universe sensing everything also raises questions if the forms of physiology involved are not learnable by people and controllable by people. Then we become the bodies colonized by the hospital. This, rather than the current concern with who gets the health records, is the beginning of a physiological privacy pillar in a system of privacy policy law. What are the rules about the collection and distribution of the information about our physiology, not least our genome? If a relative of mine decides to upload his DNA to 23andMe, it is not merely his genomic privacy which he is deciding to trade for whatever lovely genealogical discoveries he may make. He is indeed producing for the next three generations, throughout all of those who are genetically related to him, a record which will characterize and discover them in any number of contexts, not just criminal justice or political oppression contexts, but discrimination in health insurance or whatever else. Now, we can make, again, specific rules prohibiting genomic discrimination in insurance, but we will have to balance that off against the legitimate role of insurers as risk managers in society. And in order to do that, we need a regulatory framework which begins from a conception of rights. Of course, whatever we may say about such a legal structure, a privacy policy act, a privacy protection agency, verticals in behavior collection and in the process of notification and advertising and attention conscription, in the privacy of educational structures and human learning, in the phenomenon of the physiological collection and the role of privacy in the distribution of healthcare, and in the and in the role of privacy in the protection of civil rights against unequal discriminatory structures, so-called rational in nature. Those of type X are different from type Y, and they deserve to be treated differently from those of type Y. The imagination of such a legal regime, of course, presumes a politics. It presumes an understanding about how power should be distributed in society. And so we also have to understand what is the literature of the politics of our world if we are committed to the resurrection of the net we want instead of the net we do not want. And here, rather than believing that politics should be described, I find myself in the comparatively ancient, let us call it Greek, as opposed to Egyptian belief that politics should be performed. That democracy is not a theory of the depiction of society, it's a theory of the action of society. That the difference between the Greek way of thinking about the organization of social existence on the north edge of the Mediterranean and the Egyptian theory of the organization of social behavior on the south edge of the Mediterranean are fundamentally to be found in how the places work rather than they are in what they say. The idea that as the great political theorist of our time, Stephen Bannon, says at Breitbart that politics is downstream from culture, an idea that he acquired from the eponymous, now deceased, Breitbart himself, maybe is incorrect, or maybe culture is incorrectly perceived, which is why our democratic societies are under the influence of this kind of thinking descending so rapidly into Kulturkampf, into culture war. What we really mean about our politics is that we know what it is because we see what we do. We understand ourselves not on the basis of a theory of democracy, but on the conduct of our school board meetings and our town meetings in our New England towns and in what it is like to line up during an epidemic to vote in person. We discover what it is that we are in our political terms when we see how we perform. And in that sense, what I believe, as I have tried to indicate in the technical exercises we have constructed, is that we are what we teach. That our politics is the way in which we instruct one another, not de haut en bas, not like me talking to you, I'm the professor, you are the student, but like the kind of class we used to have when we all walk in and we find out what we make of it together. A politics of privacy restoration and of the return of human autonomy is a participatory politics. Like the renovation of the services market, in which we provide email servers for one another instead of all doing business with the parasite under the branding Gmail. Like the political economy structure, in which we refrain from buzzing one another in the middle of the night because, like the 20th century general rule, that it's rude in non-emergency situations to call people on the phone at 2 a.m. We don't exist in a world of rules. We exist in a world of norms. We exist in a world of shared expectations and understanding. Obviously, in writing the .communist manifesto, I was proposing a political approach to privacy. That political approach will become more important in the aftermath of the epidemic, as the process of monitoring work moves where work moves, into the home, where the upgrowth of surveillance during the process of the public health emergency remains behind, as the surveillance of the workday, now that the workday is inside the home and the surveillance is inside the home. Forms of labor organization which were centered on the factory, which grew up as work moved out of the household and into the factory between the late 17th century and the late 19th century, those forms of labor organization have really important value to workers, some of which is always there, that is, power over compensation and conditions of work. But the nature of conditions of work are changing, and the politics of the workplace is different when the workplace is the factory or the home, as the politics of educational surveillance are different when the question is the surveillance in the school and the surveillance in the home. The factory model of education is also dying. No matter how much ivy there may have been on it or how much toaster glass there was, the physical law school is different with respect to how it keeps track of us and how we wish to be kept track of than the law school you and I are at this moment in. The question is one of fundamental values. We cannot keep our politics if we lose the values upon which it is built. We cannot actually perform the politics of being together if we are never together. It's hard to have a town meeting without a hall. It's being done right this moment on Zoom, as this class is being done right this moment in its closing moments, as I speak to you into a recorder which will transfer some bits to a computer, which will transfer some bits to a website, which will transfer some bits to a laptop speaker somewhere near you, wherever you are. But in all of that intermediation, we must be at great pains not to lose our sense of togetherness. We are connected, but we are separated. The intermediaries that are the organs of the parasite have already begun to attack the coherence of our sense of togetherness in politics. This is the polarization of which everyone speaks. This is the post-truth politics of which everyone is afraid. This is the sense that we cannot tell whether our election was the most secure and fair in the history of our country or massively rigged by some immense conspiracy of Democrats, communists, and the dead Hugo Chavez to create bad software which turned votes for X into votes for Y and evicted the President of the United States by rigged it. But never will we agree until we can see one another clearly, not through a glass darkly, not through a service exchange system. The politics of privacy restoration are the politics of understanding our togetherness, not in terms of connection, but in terms of sympathy. in terms of human connection, not technological connection. In terms of human values, not technological values. And this it is no more necessary for the net to eliminate than it is necessary for the net to determine that we prefer one another's faces over one another's voices. It is no more necessary that our net should deprecate our powers of political solidarity than it is that the net should determine that we all buy our toilet paper from Amazon. What is important is that we have to understand which values matter to us and how to embed those values in the technologies that we use to live. This was a long and painful process of learning over the last 1,000 years, requiring us to understand how we felt about the ability to read whatever book we wanted, requiring us to understand why government should not determine our religious practices, let alone our religious beliefs. Requiring us to grasp why federal rather than central political institutions provide an opportunity for experiencing ourselves as self-governing people, and explaining why, at the moment of gravest crisis in the history of this society, standing amidst the dead of a civil war, it was the purpose of our most literarily capable and deeply thoughtful theorist of American democracy to say that we were fighting to preserve government of the people, by the people, for the people, lest it vanish from the earth. It is that people-centeredness which the technologies of the parasite are causing us to endanger. It is that people-centeredness which the hyper-powered despotism of the Chinese Communist Party means to deny. It is that people-centeredness which it was the goal of all this technology in its initial construction, at least for people like me who were there when the first beams were raised. It was that people-centeredness which it was the purpose of the technology to further, to free the human mind, not to monitor it, to allow self-government and self-control, not to enable the intervention of advertising in every moment of consciousness and influence in every personal decision. But that was a matter of political value only. It was a matter of the understanding of what it felt like to perform the act of being human in the world in which I grew up, a form of human acting which it may be that one generation from now, nobody will remember. Yours is the generation that determines how that process happens. From the point of view of the psychic and political evolution of the human race, as well as from the point of view of the ecological preservation of the ways we have lived in the atmosphere we had, yours is the single most important generation in the recent history of humankind, by which I mean not the last 50, not even the last 50,000, but the last 200,000 years. This course, and the subsequent inquiry into the most political of subjects, that is, how do we constitutionalize, how do we set the largest social and political parameters of our self-understanding as a society, the one I am beginning soon, and maybe some of you will be coming along on, these courses are only an attempt to bring your mind to the task, to suggest the ways in which, without you, the history of the human race will be different and potentially less free, less prosperous, less self-determined. Not everybody listening now, though you have patiently put up with me for a term, not everybody listening now will care about this 6 months from now. Not everybody listening now will ever think about this again once the grade has been received and the next phase of the job hunting has occurred. But in those we have been together, among the number of the individuals we were, something has socially occurred. I may wish that it is larger than it is, but I know that however small it is still a drop that can change the entirety of the ocean. Somebody will make this her life's work, and that life's work will change lives for generations to come. I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that you didn't altogether reject it. I even hope that you too feel, as I do, that this is only the beginning. But for whatever it is, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here, wherever here might be. Talk to you soon.